All right, welcome back, Don. Haha. Okay, we talked about egoism and all that. Now, among the thinkers who support psychological egoism, I put them up on the board. There's B.F. Skinner. Who's B.F. Skinner? Right. And which kind of psychologist? Behaviorist. And he's considered to be the most influential psychologist of all time. And any psych majors here? So you should know, you're the only one, huh? The department here is filled with behaviorists. It's crawling with behaviorists. There's no Freudians, though. And do you know Bob Brown? Do you know Professor Bob Brown? He once says it'll take maybe one more generation to just wipe them all out, the Freudians. Freud bought into this. Ayn Rand bought into this. And as I'll point out, she wrote a book, which I have in my office, called The Virtue of Selfishness. And of course, Thomas Hobbes, up on the top of the list, English philosopher from the 17th century. Now, they all subscribe to this point of view. Now, I talked about ought implies can, so you could all explain that. If you were asked to explain it, yes? Will?
Go over it.
I'll run it by you, Will. Maybe it's because you were from the other class,
Maybe
yeah.
it's because
Yes?
What was their point of view?
Oh, they subscribe to psychological egoism. They support this view. And also up on the board, I have evolutionary theory, which is also known as evolutionary psychology or sociobiology. And the founder of this sociobiology will be speaking here next semester. You should all go hear Edward O. Wilson. He is really, really a science giant. He's a professor at Harvard, entomologist, expert on ants and social insects. Yeah. What's the name of the book? Say it. Not that I know of, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he's retired now, so I could see him writing a book on something like environmentalism, and he's prolific, so I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know that book. When I teach human nature, I always use his book called On Human Nature, and he talks all about human nature, and it's all based on science. And that's what evolutionary theory is about, or sociobiology. And basically, it's interesting, I'll divert slightly and just explain. He's an expert on social insects, particularly ants. Other social insects are wasps, bees, termites. And he basically, the pr same principles that determine ant behavior determine human behavior. So it's all about things like sex and aggression. And it's very interesting to study. So anyhow, he buys into this, meaning there's a scientific basis to this view. Okay. Now, then I touched upon and explained ethical egoism, and that once again holds that one ought. Oh, I didn't do ought implies can for you, Will. Ought implies can means that if we're going to say you ought to do something, then by golly, it should be within your ability to do it. If I say you ought to do X, it implies that you are able to do X. And the problem here is in secular ethics, in normative ethics, this is seen as a major principle that you violate at your own peril. If I'm going to give you ethical directives that are not within your ability, then you will fail. Okay? And so you'll have to hear this on tape or ask somebody who was in this class Thursday or your class today, and I give some memorable explanations of ought implies can with regard to where religious ethics go wrong because they violate this principle. And they, I don't want to say they go wrong, but they fail. All right? They fail in the sense that you have people who are guilt-ridden because they can't live up to the ethical standards that their religion demands. When in truth, those demands are very appropriate for angels, but not for people. And they're not appropriate for people because they violate this principle. You see? Does that make sense or it doesn't make sense? So I have to give you examples, and then where will we be? No, religion might dictate certain things that you have to do or not do that run contrary to your nature. All right, and so the example I gave to class is premarital sex. All your traditional, old-fashioned religions don't allow premarital sex. They don't allow anything. You got to get married. So, for example, I don't think I told you this last time, but I should have. So my father, he's from Iran. His parents, these are my grandparents, how do they get around this problem? Well, my grandfather was 16 when he married my grandmother, who was 14. That's how they dealt with this, you know, how they dealt with the facts of human nature that we're sexual creatures and the religious commands not to engage in premarital sex. What they do is they essentially nip that problem in the bud and marry them real young. And in addition, I should also say, so that you don't think what my grandparents went through during their adolescence was like what you went through in your adolescence, is first of all, people there didn't have much of a concept of privacy. They didn't have their own room. They didn't have their own place where they could sort of close the door and have privacy. Didn't exist. The concept of personal privacy and personal space is a very cultural thing, you should know. All right, and if you travel, you might find that people are, you know, nice people who take you in, etc., might not have any respect for the concept of a closed door. You know, they might think nothing of you know, violating your privacy, because they don't even have a concept of personal privacy. So that's one. In other words, people back in the old country were probably had it a little bit more under control than we Americans in this time and place do, because A, they didn't have any place to go. All right. And second of all, they didn't have all the billboards, all the advertisement, all the sexual imagery, all the marketing, selling products through sex, through beautiful women, salacious women, handsome men, and all that. And you see, I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's hard to escape. All right? It's hard to, you know, your religion says be celibate. You know, ye who are in junior high and high school and college. But it's hard to do, and it's especially hard to do when all around you you're getting the sexual stimuli. All right, and advertisers, they're very smart. In fact, I think they're the best psychologists out there. They know how to sell their products, and they've tapped right into that basic belief that humans, by nature, are sexual creatures. So they figured out that they can sell a product, forget the merits of the product, they can sell the product by showing a beautiful woman holding the product. Right? So anyhow, so back in the old country, they didn't have that dynamic also. Nonetheless, when religion or anybody else gives you ethical principles that you can't live up to because you're a human being rather than an angel, it creates a lot of failure. It's not only a failure for the individuals who can't live up to that standard, it's a failure for the religion in that all these people now are walking around full of guilt, full of neuroses, conflicted. And a lot of people leave the religion, a lot of people embrace or find these things come out in other kinds of perversions. So, you know, it really isn't a win-win situation when people fail ethically, you know, pretty much to a man or to a woman. Questions on this? Anybody?
So, applying that to all of us, can we say we ought not to have premarital sex?
Look. If religion says, okay, if you grew up, and again, maybe you grew up like, I don't know, a reformed universalist Unitarian or reformed Jewish or reformed this, or, you know, there are certain religions that have brought themselves up to date, for better or for worse. Okay? But any of your old-fashioned, your traditional religions, if you're a traditional Jewish person, a traditional Catholic, a traditional Protestant, traditional Muslim, a traditional Hindu, they say no premarital sex. And, you know, you're getting the full lecture here, Will, and everyone gets, you know, gets to bear with it. And they say you can't, you know, there's no hanky-panky premarital. You're not allowed to play around, no petting, all right? They say, and you know, as I said to the class before, no organ solos. All right, nothing. No. All those doors are slammed shut on you. All right? Yet, you're 15, you're 16, you're 17, you're 18. The hormones are there. The hormones are raging. One of my colleagues describes his college days. He said, my blood was at a steady boil, you know, the whole time he was in college, which I interpreted to mean his libido was sort of running with all on all cylinders. All right? It's a biological thing. So if that's the case, but you're told no, then weird things start to happen. Weird things, from strange perversions coming up, because you know people, you know, I'm getting into more than I need to get into here, but I think a lot of perversions that people develop are because it's what was available to them in adolescence. I'm really on the subject, but I'm getting off the topic, but you know, my health is holding up here. So for example, men who are consumers of pornography, generally, I'm making an assumption, I haven't done a scientific study, but I'll bet you that when they were adolescents, when their first sexual encounters were with pornography, and once that gets imprinted during adolescence, then they're stuck on pornography for life. So for them, sex, you know, they need women to wear, I don't know, garter belts and fishnet stockings, you know, or they need, you know, they need things kinky because that's what they imprinted. Timothy Leary writes about this, by the way. I'm not making this up. Do you know who Timothy Leary is? Was? Interesting character. Give you another example. So I don't know if I mentioned Don Elster, someone I grew up with. My age, he's single. He's never going to get married. If he does, he'll marry a stripper and it will never last. He needs his women to be way out there, as he puts it. All right, so who does he date? He dates strippers. Where does he spend his time and money? He goes to strip clubs. He goes to, you know, topless bars. You know, if you go over to his house, he'll have, you know, all kinds of porno videos or things of that nature sitting around. He's a consumer of pornography. Why is he a consumer of pornography? Well, my theory, Timothy Leary's theory, you know, his brother Charlie, older brother Charlie, had this big box of Playboys and then other kinds of magazines that even I, you know, I grew up with Don Elster, I've known him since kindergarten. We used to go sneak off into Charlie's closet and just sit there and look at these magazines. But I'll bet you Don Elster, living in that house, spent a lot more time looking at those magazines than any of the rest of us. And to this day, he's like stuck on pornography. You know, he's never going to, I mean, for him, that is sex. That's what it is. And it's a shame in a way. But, you know, far be it for me to be judgmental. Now, take other good friends of mine, Louis Castellani, Dan Kogan. They've got their own little things. They are completely into like going to nude beaches. All right. They like going backpacking to go to these hot springs where hopefully they'll find naked women there too. This is what they enjoy. Why do they enjoy this? Because when they were in junior high and high school, this is where they got their sexual imagery from. This is what imprinted, you know, in their minds. And so they love that. You know, that's what they really, really look forward to, and they devote, you know, weeks of the year to go on these backpacking trips or go on these hiking trips, which you ask, if you ask me, is a whole hell of a lot better than going to strip clubs. But still, you know, they're sort of stuck on that. And so the argument is what people get imprinted during the impressionable time of adolescence sort of lasts them for a very, you know, for a lifetime, which is one argument why pornography is not a good thing or these brothels are not a good thing, because for many people this is just normal. You know, this is what they know. All right, now you can stop me and ask me questions on that if you wish. All right? You know, that's come up in classes before. That's not the first time I've talked about that. But but anyhow, I often call Dan or Lou on my drive back, and just so I'll be happy to tell them that I spoke about them in this context, see what they say. All right. So anyhow, ethical egoism basically says now, look, this is a fact of human nature. Anything else is not going to work. Therefore, the best we can do is to take this fact of human nature, which is psychological egoism, which is descriptive, describes what is the case, and channel that into ethical egoism, which holds that one ought to pursue self-interest as an end in itself. One should pursue well-being. It's the right thing to do. Now, ethical egoism, just on the face of it, takes no particular stand on what your interest is. It doesn't make any claim, or it doesn't have any kind of theory of what is the good, or what your welfare or well-being or interest consist in. However, we're serious here. And so those who are taking this seriously, pardon me, those who are taking this seriously generally come up with ideas and of ethical egoism, which essentially have some enlightened self-interest as the concept, as the operative concept. You're going to pursue self-interest anyway. Let's educate you. Let's enlighten you so that you pursue an enlightened self-interest. Let's broaden your perspective so you're not some selfish, greedy, individual who only thinks of herself, but let's also now channel this energy and make you into a person who recognizes that it's in your interest to see the people around you and the people, you know, your fellow countrymen and your fellow humans and your fellow creatures of the planet happy. All right? So generally speaking, when you get down to the nuts and bolts of actual theories of ethical egoism, they're essentially trying to channel an appeal to your self-interest to do the right thing. And by the way, every religion that I know of preaches altruism, yet appeals to your self-interest. Every religion I know of tells you to do kind deeds for others without thinking of the reward, and every religion gives you an idea of what kind of rewards you're going to get if you're a good person, and punishments you'll get if you're a bad person. I don't know a religion that doesn't do that. Why? Because they're bowing to the facts of human nature. Every religion gives you that carrot and stick in terms of, you should be good because you're rewarded, and you shouldn't be bad because you get punished. That's an appeal to self-interest. All right, so now, the way I can drive this point home, and this is sort of the last thing, I could say quite a bit on it, but the last thing to say on this topic, and then we'll go to the welfare state, assuming I can hang on here. And it is that lest you think, oh, that's just what I'm learning in class, and that's just some theoretical thing, our economic system is based on this. Who of you are from the business school? All right, so you're business majors? Well, correct me if I'm wrong. The capitalist system supposes that each one of us individually is a self-interested agent, and you go spend your money where it's in your interest to do so. If you want convenience, then you might spend a little more because you want convenience. If you want the best prices, you'll go to where there's a sale. All right. You might say, in theory, ideally, I like small businesses and mom-pa stores, and that's where I'm going to go shop, but you end up going to Walmart because it's cheaper and it's more convenient. People pursue self-interest. The economic system is based on that. How they price items, when they put items on sale, it's based on the assumption that the customers are going to be self-interested. All right? Continuing, the economic system the capitalist system presupposes this egoism, and it's a good thing. The idea here now is that it's in my interest to look out for me. It's in my interest that you look out for you. No one's going to look out for you better than you. All right? And it's in my interest that you all become successful, productive members of society. Forget the extra added fact that, say, I'm your teacher and you're my student, and if you succeed in life, it's good for me, it's good for business, it's good for UNCW, just citizen to citizen, all right? Don't have to be my student. You could be up in Alaska. It's in my interest that people there succeed, that their businesses flourish, that their careers are good, that their family lives are happy, because it's not in my interest that they should end up in prison. It's not in my interest that anybody should go on the public dole. All right, so I don't want to see you or anyone go on welfare. All right, that's not good for me. All right, and I hope you can see that. All right, it's in your interest that I be a good father to my children. All right, why? Because it is clearly not in your interest that my boys become juvenile delinquents and end up in prison. All right, and it's not in your interest that my boys, you know, can't hold down a job and go on unemployment. Or now I'm about to sneeze. So anyhow, the whole system is geared toward egoism, and the system works because, let's just say, people do pursue self-interest. So, you know, Adam Smith gives a nice example. I'll, you know, put my own embellishments on it. But say you sit down and eat a sandwich. All right? Now, if you think about all that went into getting that bread in your hands to, you know, make that sandwich, you'd have to go back to the grocer who sold you the bread, to the trucker who brought the bread to the market, to the baker who baked the bread, to the miller who made the flour and sold it to the baker, to the grain dealer who bought the grain from the farmer who grew it. That farmer back in Kansas was not thinking about you and your sandwich here in Wilmington, not at all. That farmer, that grain dealer, that miller, that baker, that trucker, and all the other truckers in between, they were thinking of their own self-interest. That's what made them get up and leave their homes and work to make money, and that's what they're thinking about. But because they're looking out for themselves, it kind of works, you know, this is the invisible hand of capitalism, of the market system. It works. People pursue self-interest, and it's in your interest that people pursue their self-interest. It's very simple. All right. How and why did socialism fail? Did I talk about this last time? There's a lot of reasons. But the number one reason why the Soviet Union collapsed, the number one reason is that people weren't hardworking. And why should they be hardworking when they get no extra reward for hard work? If we're into equality and everyone gets the same and we don't believe in overtime because we don't want anyone to get ahead, then why should I work hard if everyone else is slacking off? Patriotism? Most people will not work hard if there's nothing in it for them. Similarly, China, and again, this is the Chinese communists, back when they were still real communists, they had to bite the bullet on this one, but they came to the undeniable conclusion that farmers are far more productive when they grow what they want to grow than when they're told by the government what to grow. You know, and under communism, you don't have a market economy, you have a command economy. You have these commissars figuring out we need so many bushels of soybeans. So they say, you grow soybeans. And we need so many bushels of broccoli, you grow broccoli. And that's what they had to do. And you have to grow this much broccoli, and usually they have to work real hard to grow that much broccoli. Farmers will be even more productive if they have to, in addition to the broccoli they have to grow, and even though it's hard to grow all that broccoli on the land they've got, if they're allowed to grow whatever else they can fit in and sell that on their own. All right, and they realized, instead of telling them to grow broccoli and then have a little bit for your own, just grow whatever you want to grow, and they'll produce much more based on self-interest than they will when they're told what to do. All right, and little by little, the system unraveled because they recognized, you know, this is what works. I have this quote. This is, you know, in the New York Times, there's the quotation of the day. So the Kremlin, his, the chief economic strategist of the, you know, of the Soviet Union, basically said, our national tragedy is we put the collective we in front of the personal I, and it doesn't work that way, and therefore, you know, we couldn't produce. We couldn't outproduce you. You know, that was our national tragedy. And again, when you have a situation where people own their business, own their homes, own their cars, they take better care of it than when they're simply renting, all right, or simply employees, which is why I told you last time, the government discriminates against apartment renters because it gives homeowners a phenomenally good, unfair tax break by allowing you to write off the interest of the mortgage payments that you make. All right, so you borrow money to buy a house, it's generally a good deal because you're not paying dollar for dollar when you pay back all that money in interest, because all the interest you get to write off. All right, so the government allows, it encourages home ownership. Why? Because when people own their homes, they take better care of their homes. When people own their homes, the property values are higher. The homes are painted, the lawns are made. All that is, people take better care of it. All right, just like when you rent a car, all right, or you stay in a hotel room. All right, people who stay in hotel rooms. Any of you ever work in a hotel? All right, so correct me if this is wrong or if this sound strikes you as odd, but everyone I know who's ever worked in a hotel takes this dim view of human nature. People are pigs. All right, people are pigs because they take things from the hotel. They trash things in the hotel. They, I don't like hotels. All right, because people will say, you know, oh, let's not put a diaper on the baby for a little while. Let's let the kid breathe, you know. And kid pees on the carpet, who cares? You know, I'll be out of there tomorrow morning and it won't start smelling. This is people's mentality. They don't care. All right, when it's their own, they care. People take the towels from the hotel and scrub their cars with it, you know, and then return them. Or people just keep the towels. You go to a hotel in Europe, your room key, I don't know, maybe now it's all computer cards or something, but back in the day, the room key would be on this giant, like, paperweight, such that you couldn't keep the key as a souvenir or forget the key or even put the key in your pocket. You have to return the key to the desk when you leave the hotel because the key's on this, like, 5-pound weight. This is their appreciation of human nature. Okay, so the failure of socialism and the success of capitalism can be attributed to this. Questions on this? All right, let me make a run for it here. A run for it in terms of trying to get you through the welfare state real quick. And even though it goes against everything I believe, I might let you out early. Although Tuesday, usually people get out early on review day. Okay, we have 15 minutes. Let's see if I can cut it down to 8. All right. Welfare. Now, you read Peter Singer, right? Yes? All right. So Peter Singer takes a very uncompromising utilitarian view that you're pretty much morally obligated not to spend money on frivolous luxuries, but to donate money to charity. Because, as he says, that $1,000 that you might spend on a trip or you might spend on a new wardrobe could save 5 people. All right, that could mean education for, you know, a bunch of third world children. So, you know, basically there's a moral idea put out toward you that you're responsible for your brother, for your neighbor, for your fellow human being. All right, that's something for you to think about. By the way, Peter Singer is also completely into animal rights. And if any of you are interested in Peter Singer, there's going to be a whole seminar on him next semester taught by Janelle Durstein, if any of you are interested. Anyhow, in the good old days or the bad old days, we didn't have any welfare. All right, everybody had to sink or swim on their own. The government did not give you any kind of safety net. It was not the government's job to bail you out if you lost your job, if, your husband who's the sole breadwinner, you know, dropped dead of a heart attack, you're on your own. In the good old days, or the bad old days, depending on how you see it, people had a lot more liberty because the government wasn't as responsible. And if you think about it, if I have to pay the medical bills of drug addicts or overeaters, then, or people who are addicted to, you know, junk food and fast food, then it's actually my business what they eat or how they recreate, you know, if they want to do drugs when they're recreating. In the good old days, the government wasn't responsible, which meant theoretically you should have a lot more freedom to do whatever you want. You want to drink yourself into, so your liver is pickled, your business, your family's business, not the government's business. If I have to pay for your bad choices and reckless lifestyles, that's a different matter. But in any case, in the good old days, people relied on their family. People relied on their church groups, on their neighborhood, in the community. As we've had a major demographic shift to cities and urbanization, as we've shifted from the extended family to the nuclear family, and from the nuclear family to the dysfunctional family, people can't rely on this on that system like they used to. Yes?
What do you mean by nuclear family?
Nuclear family, yeah, I meant to ask, I was thinking, should I ask, do you know what nuclear family is? Nuclear, here it means just sort of the real central, the nucleus of the family, which would be father, mother, and children. So generally people think of, you know, father, mother, two kids and a dog and a station wagon and a house in the suburbs. But the nuclear family is without all the aunts and uncles and cousins, and maybe the grandparents could be thrown into the mix. And if you think of when people lived in communities, again, my father back in Iran, you know, there's the whole extended family there. And everyone is poor, but everyone takes care of everybody else. Everyone's responsible for everybody else. You know, that's the first line of defense, is the family. You know, someone loses his job, well, the family, you know, they'll tighten their belts and, you know, no one's going to starve. All right, but we've gone from the extended family to the nuclear family. And this is really like a post-World War II baby boom phenomenon, that there's just much more centralization of the, you know, Ozzie and Harriet model. You know, do you watch your Leave It to Beaver or Ozzie and Harriet, you know, your old 50s sitcoms? You know, it's basically the father and mother and the two kids.
The
immediate family. And now, not even the nuclear family is functioning like it used to. So that, again, I don't need any show of hands, but statistically speaking, most of you would come from a dysfunctional family on some level, or a single parent home. All right, there's a lot of that going around. All right, so we no longer have the support network that we used to. All right, in the good old days, everyone pulled their own weight. You know, you stand and fall on your own. Now, obviously, some people had big advantages. They had wealth. They had maybe they didn't have wealth, but they had a generous, loving, big extended family, or they had good luck. Period. In the good old days, the bad old days, life was tough. It was unfair, and there wasn't equality. It was unequal. You know, death and poverty were much more prevalent. But what happened historically is we had this Great Depression, all right, in the 1930s. You know about that? You know about this? Should hope so. Yeah, you don't know? Okay. Well, basically, we had like the Roaring Twenties, right, and then that all came to an abrupt halt in October of 1929 when the stock market crashed. And when the stock market crashed, that basically led to a chain reaction where lots of people were wiped out financially. Lots of people lost their jobs. And when you lose your job, you no longer are paying for the gardener and for the piano lessons and, you know, for trips and other places where you spend money that circulates in the economy. The banks collapsed. So people had savings, but the banks didn't have the money. The banks had the money in the stock market, gone with the wind. That's why we now have the federally insured savings deposits, you know, because people were wiped out through no fault of their own, but the banks failed. All right, so it was a sad situation, and the unemployment rate in the United States was something like 30%. All right, where you had people who were millionaires are now paupers, and jobs are scarce. And if you look at what things cost in the 1930s, oh man, was it cheap back then. You know, pennies would buy you a lot, all right, because the people just didn't have money. You know, the prices all had to come down. So, with the Great Depression, you had, a failure of the capitalist system. I just sang you the virtues of the capitalist system. Well, the Great Depression shows you the viciousness of the capitalist system. And just to rub that point, drive that point home even deeper, you should know that the stock market crash and the Great Depression happened on the watch of very pro-business Republican presidents. You know, Calvin Coolidge, everything was fine under Coolidge, but the stage was set for Herbert Hoover, and the Depression hit, and he just wasn't able to do much about it. In comes Franklin Delano Roosevelt, all right, who, without a doubt, love him or hate him, whatever you might think, will go down as the greatest president of the 20th century. All right, for a number of reasons. But he, and the main reason was, not only did he hold the office, as Archie Bunker would say, as if he was the Pope, you know, he was elected like four times. I don't know if you're aware of that. You know, they changed, you know, the two-term limit. Well, they didn't stick with that under Roosevelt. But what Roosevelt did, I mean, he was the president during the Depression. He was the president during World War II. So much of the world today that we have is because of Roosevelt. Now, what Roosevelt did is he brought in the welfare state. This was un-American. This was completely foreign to our capitalist nature. All right. And to top it off, Roosevelt was a traitor to his class. Roosevelt was an aristocrat. He was rich. He was not, you know, from the common folk. He was an American aristocrat. Yet what he did was offend all the aristocrats by bringing in a welfare state, by completely changing the nature of the tax system. All right, so now everyone's going to have to pay taxes, including and especially the rich. And we Americans believe in small government, but now we're going to have much bigger government, because when you have a welfare state, you need to administer it. All right, and by welfare, we're now saying that the government's going to provide a safety net for people. They're going to start with welfare, giving people money who are out of work, giving people who are unemployed unemployment compensation, providing health care benefits for people. And all this, you should know, costs money. This doesn't come out of nowhere. This means you need a much bigger government, and you need the taxes to pay for that government. Now, to the cries and the screams of those who were opposed to this, and there were many, and they were the rich and powerful, not the poor and downtrodden, Roosevelt basically, you know, it wasn't stated necessarily, but the reason he could drive home or drive through this radical legislation, which, as I said, goes against the America as people knew it back then, was if we don't do this, if we don't help out people, then we will have a revolution. You know, just like they had in Russia, all right, and like they might have in Germany, they might have in Europe, because the Depression hit Europe sooner than it hit America. If we don't do this, then we'll have a revolution, and all you rich fat cats, you're not just going to get taxed, you're going to lose everything, all right, because if there's a revolution, you'll be the enemy, and the peasants, you know, the working class will clean you out completely, and you'll have nothing. So it's in your interest to go along with me. You might want to go kicking and screaming, but it's in your interest to help me see this through. Otherwise, you're going to lose everything. And you'd rather have to pay taxes than lose everything. I'm not sure if I have my my facts straight on this, because it just came up at lunch, the lunch that I shall never forget now, where somebody else at lunch was saying that he took his family to see the Vanderbilt estate in Asheville. All right, and you know, and he said it's so wrong that people built these palaces when other people didn't have enough to eat, and you know, people were poor. Have any of you been to the Vanderbilt estate? I haven't been there, but apparently it was on 32,000 acres. Now it's only 8,000 acres, but you know, they had a, you know, I don't know, 1,200 rooms at this man. Just, he was going on and on about it, but you know, back in the day, these robber baron capitalists could build these things and they didn't have to pay tax on it. Why did the Vanderbilt give it to the state? Because once the rules change and they have to pay tax on it, even they can't afford it. All right, and again, I'm from California, so San Simeon, you have the Hearst Castle. Any of you see the film Citizen Kane? Greatest American film ever made, roughly based on William Randolph Hearst. He built this castle. Beautiful place. They just gave it to the state, you know, because they couldn't pay the taxes on it. Or Will Rogers, you heard of Will Rogers, the humorist, you know. Will Rogers State Park in Los Angeles, beautiful place, lovely place. This was Will Rogers, you know, 10,000 acres, whatever it is, in L.A., all right? And, you know, once they start taxing that stuff, Will Rogers was already dead, but the family, they can't pay for it. Donate it to the state. So the rules changed. with Roosevelt. And basically, you know, we created a welfare state, and we haven't been able to get rid of it since. All right? Once you start these things, they're hard to stop. Now, I have lots to say. Let me look at the time. It's time. Let me dismiss you.